Good afternoon. May it please the court, Mr. Lee. My name is Gail Johnson, bar registration number 29703, and I represent Robert Ray in this appeal. Your Honor, I aspire to reserve approximately 10 minutes for rebuttal, and I welcome any reminders the court is willing to give. Thank you. Mr. Ray's convictions must be reversed in this case under the Colorado Supreme Court precedent of DiBella versus People. In DiBella, the Colorado Supreme Court reaffirmed a long-standing principle in criminal cases in Colorado. The trial courts have an affirmative obligation to ensure that a jury is not permitted to use exhibits in a manner that is unfairly prejudicial to a party. Therefore, DiBella holds, a trial court must exercise discretion in order to avoid the likelihood that a deliberating jury would give undue weight or emphasis to a particular exhibit. In Mr. Ray's case, the district court failed to fulfill that obligation. I think it's important for this court to understand the chronology of when the case law developed in relation to when Mr. Ray's case was tried. This case was tried in 2006. In 2007, the Colorado Supreme Court issued the Frasco case, which first reaffirmed these principles, and then in 2010, DiBella was issued. So at the time the district court was making its ruling in Mr. Ray's case, it did not have Frasco or DiBella before it. But again, those cases reaffirmed long-standing principles and are applicable to Mr. Ray on direct appeal. Instead, the universe of law that the trial court was looking at in 2006 was a trio of cases issued by this court in, I think, 2003, Colavan, 2003, McKinney, and 2005, the Isom case, which had been this trial court's own case up on appeal, so he clearly remembered it very well. Those cases interpreted a 1999 change in the civil rules of procedure to mean that trial courts could and should give unfettered access to exhibits, including videotaped witness statements, to the deliberating jury. The prosecutor relied on that trio of case law in arguing this jury should have unfettered access.
How do you show prejudice? I mean, let's assume that there was a DiBella violation. What's the prejudice here, given that it doesn't appear that the record shows that the jury ever requested to view the video again?
Well, Your Honor, the ruling at issue is the trial court's ruling that the jury could have the DVD. There was no expectation that there would be any kind of juror note coming out or further discussion with the parties when they wanted to watch it. What happened then was some discussion about ministerial acts of making sure they had the equipment available to view it.
Well, counsel, in Frasco there was a record. There was a record of just that, that the jury had requested to view the video and that the video had then been provided to the jury. In DiBella, the court expressly said in its opinion that the video had been provided to the jury in the jury room. So we have a record in each of those cases that the video was actually provided to the jury. And in this case, all we have is a record that says that the video and the equipment will be placed in a back hallway and we'll have to, the bailiff will be instructed on what to do if they ask for it. That's all we've got. So we have no idea whether the jury ever saw it again.
Your Honor, I think the record is a little different than what the court just articulated, and I also think the court's language in DiBella answers this question. First of all, with respect to the record here, it is not the case that there is a record that the DVD was left in the hallway. To the contrary, the clear implication from the record is that the DVD was given to the deliberating jury along with the other exhibits.
I'd like to cite to the record, because I'm looking at it right now, and I got the quotes from the court that say to the contrary. The contrary, the court says, I'm telling the prosecution, because the court doesn't have the equipment, I'm telling the prosecution to do what they usually do, which is to take the equipment and the DVD, put it in a certain back hallway. That's all we've got. That's it.
Your Honor, what the record says is that it's my usual practice to leave it in the back hallway, it being the equipment.
But the court said it didn't have the equipment. It didn't have any equipment it could give the jury. It was up to the prosecutor to provide it.
Correct, Your Honor. And at that point, what the court is saying, the court has already ruled that it's giving this access to the jury. And the only thing that's being discussed is to make sure that the prosecutors aren't the ones to go into the jury room with the equipment. And that's why the prosecutors being the custodians of the equipment available, the court says my usual practice is to have it in the hallway. But I think what I really want to direct this court's attention to is the language in DiBella, because DiBella makes clear that the absence of a record like this in this scenario, where the trial court has failed to exercise its discretion to ensure supervision, does not cut against the defendant.
And actually, DiBella talks about the absence of a record of what occurred in the jury room. There was an actual record that the video, wasn't a DVD, but the video in that case went to the jury room. There was an actual record of that. The court said the hour-long tape was provided to the jury, end quote. The prosecution was saying on appeal, we don't know what happened in the jury room. We don't know if they actually viewed it in the jury room. That was the absence of record that the DiBella court was talking about, not the kind of absence of record we have here as to whether the jury ever saw it again.
Ms. Johnson, suppose the record affirmatively showed that the jury never viewed the video again. Would your argument be the same?
No. If the record affirmatively showed that, then I think we would be having a different discussion today about harmlessness. But I'd like to quote from DiBella, if I may, and this is at page 668. The court's failure to exercise some control over the jury's access to the video, ellipsis, leaves us without any record as to how or even if the jury reviewed the tape. From this, the people argue it would be speculative to presume they watched the video at all, to say nothing of whether they gave it undue weight or emphasis. Of course, on a record devoid of any information about the jury's use of the tape, it is equally speculative to presume that the jury did not review the tape. Contrary to the people's urging at oral argument, such a complete lack of record evidence does not weigh in their favor. To so hold would be to undermine the very purpose of appellate review.
I'm fully aware of that quote.
Okay.
But the context of that quote is the prosecution was saying we have to have a record of whether the jury in the jury room reviewed the video. The court said expressly that the video had been given to the jury in the jury room. The record on that was clear and undisputed, as it was in Frasco. Okay? We have a different kind of record here. All we have is a ruling in a vacuum. We don't have any record that the video actually went to the jury. In fact, the indication in the record is it was not. Well, you're asking us to speculate that there might have been some request by the jury to get it out of the hallway, that they might have talked to the bailiff might have shown how to work it, all that stuff. It's just not in the record. As it was in Frasco, that was in Frasco.
Well, Your Honor, let me return to Frasco. I know the court asked a question earlier about Frasco because we do have a record in Frasco. The reason we have a record in Frasco, and one of the factors that caused the court not to reverse in that case, is because the court accepted defense counsel's request there to require and wait until the deliberating jury sent out a request for the video exhibit before it would be given to the jury. That is not what happened here. Mr. Ray's trial counsel specifically asked for that particular safeguard, as well as the safeguard that any viewing of the video be conducted in the presence of the parties, meaning an open court. And instead of doing that, the trial court here abused its discretion by failing to exercise it by relying on this construction of case law from the Palavan, Isom, and McKinney cases. And that is error under DiBella. I think I respectfully part ways with the court on the, and I don't want to parse words here, but I think it's important to the court, obviously. There's no suggestion that the DVD itself was in the hallway. To the contrary, the judge said, I'm giving the exhibits, including the video exhibit of Jeremy Green's pretrial interview, to the jury.
Well, the only discussion about the DVD, they have to have the equipment. Okay, if they have the DVD without the equipment, that's meaningless, right?
Of course, Your Honor.
Okay.
But I think I want to be clear that the only discussion about the hallway is after the court has already ruled as a ministerial act of how are we going to make this equipment available to them and making sure that the prosecutor doesn't go in the deliberating jury room. And that's the colloquy that happens.
Well, let me quote from the court's ruling on this. Quote, I'll require from the prosecutor, this isn't talking hypothetically, I'll require from the prosecution that they make available a DVD with associated equipment like a TV screen, whatever is needed to play. And then later, as you mentioned, there's a discussion of how that's going to happen. And the court says they usually will enter the back hallway and just leave it there. And I leave it there until the jury calls for it, end quote. How are we supposed to deduce from that record that the equipment got back to the jury, along with the DVD?
Your Honor, again, our first position is always under DiBella, under that clear precedent, the lack of record here does not cut against Mr. Ray. It cuts against the trial court and the state in this case. Second, I would also remind the court of this court's decision in the Jefferson case, which says that the fact that the prosecutor during closing argument urged the jury to watch the video strongly indicates a strong likelihood that it gave it careful consideration and weight. We have that here in spades. We have the prosecution arguing the video and the supposed threats twice in opening, nine times in closing arguments, including seven direct quotes, and then specifically urging the jury to watch it and then talking about watching it. I think the issue of whether the equipment may have been left in the hallway is a distinction without a difference. There is nothing in the record that the state can point to that would suggest that the court or anyone else was expecting a note from the jury saying, okay, now we want the DVD player. If it were left in the hallway.
You mean when the court says, I leave it there until the jury calls for it, that's not such an indication? That it's expecting a request?
Not a formal request that's going to be discussed amongst the party then of do we or do we not give it to them or do we bring them into the courtroom, because the court has already ruled.
Well, was there any effort made in the trial court to supplement the record to try and figure out what precisely did happen with the equipment and with the DVD?
No, Your Honor.
And whose problem is that? You're claiming the judgment should be reversed on that basis. Isn't it the defendant's burden if the record is insufficient to support your argument? I understand your argument that it's basically an automatic reversal, but assuming we don't buy that, isn't it the defendant's argument to go to the trial court and say, we need to supplement the record here and maybe call the bailiff as a witness to figure out whether the bailiff ever brought the equipment into the jury room?
No, Your Honor, and I would refer the court again to the Colorado Supreme Court's clear language in DiBella, and this is the nearly concluding paragraph on page 669. Quote, the trial court had an obligation to observe caution that the tape was not used in such a manner as to create a likelihood of it being given undue weight or emphasis by the jury. On this nearly silent record, we cannot conclude that this obligation was fulfilled, end quote. And the court in DiBella, of course, reverses. So we have
a situation. The court didn't reverse just because the district court had misapprehended the law. The court reversed because the district court had misapprehended the law and given the tape to the jurors. What I'm questioning here is the record support for the latter. I just don't see any record support for the fact that it actually got to the jurors.
And Your Honor, had the court accepted defense counsel's request that they wait for the jury to ask for it and that they do it supervised in the courtroom, we would have a different record, but the court did not. The court instead accepted the prosecution's request that there is no discretion, there's no discretion to exercise here, and under Isom and Palavan, you simply need to give it to them. I think the fact that the equipment under the court's usual practices in the hallway is a distinction without a difference. It's just like we wouldn't expect a jury note to come out saying we're ready for sandwiches now for lunch. That's not a legal, you know, the exhibit is with them, it's been given to them. They are walking in and out on a daily basis, presumably past that if it is even in the hallway.
Well, we don't know that the exhibit was given to them. In fact, the court indicated the contrary. He said he would require the prosecution to make available a DVD because the court was keeping its own DVD. It did not take the DVD and give it to the jury.
And Your Honor, I'm happy to address that record site on rebuttal and respond to the court then. But I think, again, the clear import of the court's ruling is I cannot exercise discretion under these cases, which the Colorado Supreme Court has since soundly disapproved.
I understand. I think what happened here on this record is the court made it available in the hallway. Well, it'll be available, they'll ask for it, and we'll give it to them. And what the court was saying is that once they get it back there, I'm not going to control how they view it or how many times they view it. And that ruling, as you point out under DiBella, would be erroneous, because if it goes back, at least under Frasco, the court has to give them some kind of an instruction not to give the video greater weight than any other piece of evidence. But we just didn't get, I guess what I'm concerned about is we don't have a record that we ever got to that point where the court had to make any kind of a, I mean, the court made a decision, but it hadn't been implemented, I guess is what I'm saying on this record.
Unless your argument basically for automatic reversal is correct, isn't the most you're entitled to is a remand to the trial court to make findings as to whether the jury, in fact, did view the DVD again?
Your Honor, I think such a remand order would be contrary to DiBella, because again, the Colorado Supreme Court recognized that they did not know whether the jury even viewed that video during deliberations one sole time. And on that record, they did not remand for further factual development. Instead, they reversed the convictions, and that's what Mr. Ray seeks here.
But in DiBella, there was no dispute that the video was in the court, in the jury room, was there? And with the equipment?
No, but again, I think
what we don't know here is whether or not the video was in the courtroom with the equipment to be seen. The record does not, the record seems to contradict that, but at best, it's unclear.
And I think that ambiguity, like the ambiguity in DiBella, is of the same piece.
But in DiBella, they had the equipment and they had the DVD. The question is whether they pushed a button to play it. Here, that's not the issue.
I guess my position is that's a distinction without a difference,
okay.
And DiBella controls.
Thank you.
And the court has mentioned a couple of times automatic reversal. I want to be clear. I think the standard is whether the court has grave doubts about whether this unfettered access to the exhibit affected the fairness of Mr. Dre's trial. And that's what we've argued in our briefs. And certainly here, when you have a video that is so central to the issue of intent to kill, and where the prosecutor argues it heavily at trial, and where the state argues it on appeal, this court must have a grave doubt about the fairness.
So just to be clear, so the standard of review here is because this was objected to, so it's preserved.
Correct.
I don't think there's any dispute about that.
Correct.
So the standard review is harmless error, isn't it? Just the ordinary harmless error.
The standard of review is abuse of discretion.
Yeah, in terms of whether.
And the standard for reversal is
reversal.
Whether the court has a grave doubt about the fairness, yes. If I could turn now to the second issue we've noticed for appeal, which is that the trial court also failed to fulfill its obligation under the Lowe versus People case in this situation to avoid an undue risk that the jury's verdict resulted from coercion. The legal standard from the Colorado Supreme Court's decision is Lowe, is that circumstances that present an undue risk that a jury verdict in a criminal case has been coerced require reversal of the defendant's convictions. I want to be clear that the circumstances presented here are those rare and unusual circumstances. The trial court received a note from the deliberating jury, stating, the time has come to seek removal from this jury obligation. The cost is too great for my company, family, and time to continue this pursuit of justice. There does not appear to be a reasonable end in sight without compromising my beliefs in what those who came before me fought hard to defend, justice for all. That was the note. And that note revealed three important things. It revealed that this juror harbored a mistaken belief in indefinite jury deliberations. It revealed that this juror was in a minority of one whose holdout vote was preventing the jury from reaching unanimity and thereby ending deliberations. And this note demonstrated that the juror believed that unanimity could be reached and deliberations ended only if he compromised his belief in justice. Now, the fact that this juror mistakenly believed that there was no way out of the jury room other than unanimity is understandable given the instructions that had been given. Instruction number 29 told the jury that their verdict had to be unanimous, and at no time was the jury instructed that if they failed to reach unanimity, a mistrial could be declared.
What was the timing? When did the jurors start deliberating in relation to when this note was submitted?
Your Honor, jurors started deliberating near the end of the day. I think it was approximately after 4:30 p.m. on day one of deliberations. They came back on day two and had a full second day of deliberations. During that day, the jury sent out three different notes, each of which was responded to by the trial court, even on one occasion, at least with a response that simply said, I cannot answer your question. Then this note was handed out via the foreperson before deliberations commenced on day three of deliberations. Deliberations commenced on day three at 9 a.m. There was discussion about the note separately from the jury, the trial court, and the counsel, and nothing then was done. No further instruction, no further inquiry until the jury reaches its verdict at 12:55. So nearly 4 hours, this juror, who had expressed a concern that the only way he could reach agreement with others was to compromise his beliefs, he's left there with no response.
Well,
and that's
counsel, the record shows that in response to this question, the prosecutor actually suggested that they question this jury, and defense counsel objected to that. And now you're on appeal, you're saying that's what should have happened. They should have questioned the juror.
Your Honor, to the contrary, what the prosecutor suggested was that the juror should be removed.
No, he suggested both. He suggested either removal of the juror or that the juror be questioned, and defense counsel just straight up objected to that.
Your Honor, defense counsel objected to removal of the jury because I think everyone sensed that this was potentially a holdout juror for acquittal.
But the defense counsel didn't merely object. She said, this juror has to serve. We can't just let this juror off. We have to keep this juror on.
And that's correct. What should have happened is not removal of the juror. What should have happened is an instruction or a response that said, do not surrender your honest convictions about the weight or effect of the evidence solely for the purpose of reaching agreement with other jurors. That's a standard instruction that has been given in Colorado since at least the 1970s, that was in place in the stock instructions at the time of Mr. Ray's trial, and that's in place in the 2014 stock instructions. It's a part of a modified Allen instruction that encourages jurors to try to reach agreement, but again, tells them not to sacrifice their honest beliefs. And here's why this is so critical.
Ms. Johnson?
Yeah.
Well, my notes indicate that what the court said was that the note was not sufficient at this point to make a determination that this juror should be excused or further inquiry should be made of the juror. No objection was made by the defendant. Why isn't that invited error?
Your Honor, the invited error doctrine requires a defendant to affirmatively inject error into the case. That's not what happened here. And I think if the court looks at the Colorado Supreme Court's trio of decisions this year in the modified Allen instruction cases, they're very instructive. The Gibbons case, the Martin case, and the Fain case. And on 11 occasions in those cases, Gibbons, paragraph 4, 13, 28, 33, and 36, Martin, paragraph 4, 17, 28, Fain, paragraph 4, 16, and 23. On those 11 occasions, what the Colorado Supreme Court said is that trial courts should consider exercising their discretion to instruct the jury about the possibility of a mistrial in the rare circumstance, quote, when a jury has actually indicated a mistaken belief in indefinite deliberations, end quote. That rare circumstance is precisely the circumstance that Mr. Ray's case presents. This is a very unusual note, and it gave rise to an affirmative obligation in the trial court to make sure that that juror did not compromise his beliefs based on the coercion either from other jurors or from the press of time because of his own financial issues.
Counsel, if it's not invited error, it's at least plain error review, correct?
Your Honor, I think whether it's plain error or structural error, I think reversal is required. I mean, this is not...
Well, there's a big difference between plain error and structural error.
Well, Your Honor, I think the plain error standard talks about substantial fairness. And what you have here is the compromise of the right to a unanimous jury verdict. It's not the kind of error that can be assessed against the evidence at trial. It's not an evidentiary ruling. It goes to the heart of the fairness of our jury system. And to have a juror who's expressing concern that he will have to compromise in order to end deliberations, nothing else is sent back, and then the verdict comes out, that's an undue risk. And I think it's important to focus on that language from the Lowe case. It's not Mr. Ray's burden to prove on appeal that this juror was coerced. The question is whether there were circumstances creating an undue risk of juror coercion, and that we have here in spades.
Would your argument be the same if the time sequence was the note and then 15 minutes later a verdict? Would your argument be the same as it is with, as I understand it, a four-hour interval?
I don't think it would be as strong, Your Honor. Not at all. I think the 4 hours matters very much. I also want to direct this court's attention to the position that the government, the state, took in the Gibbons case, again, decided by the Colorado Supreme Court this year. At paragraph 28, the Colorado Supreme Court notes that the people agreed that in the unusual circumstance when a jury indicates a mistaken belief and never-ending deliberations, Failing to inform the jury about the possibility of a mistrial is itself coercive, and I think...
Is there any evidence that any other juror believed that an outcome was that they were deadlocked?
Your Honor...
All we have is one juror who everybody knew from the beginning didn't want to be there, that he was busy, he had a lot of other things to do, saying, "This is taking too long, let me go." And that doesn't necessarily mean a deadlock. It may just mean it's going to take a while to reach a verdict.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's what the note says. What the note says is the only way we can end these deliberations is for me to compromise my belief.
No, only way to do it within, I think he said, a reasonable time. And what he meant by a reasonable time, I can't speculate to.
Your Honor, again, I think the standard is, do these circumstances present an undue risk? There is risk palpable in that note. He's talking about compromising his beliefs in justice. And the fact, whether it's one
Maybe
juror
he was
or
the
multiple,
holdout for finding Mr. Ray guilty of first-degree murder. I mean, there's a lot of speculation in your analysis.
And certainly, certainly Colorado's rules don't allow us to penetrate the deliberations
right.
in that way, but I think that's why the appropriate standard is whether there's this undue risk, because again, it's not our burden to prove what did or didn't happen in that jury room. The question
but he didn't say they were deadlocked, did he? He just said, I don't see a reason, we're going to get done in a reasonable time, and I got to be working and making money.
There's no other possible construction of the note than if he changed his vote, the jury deliberations would end.
But that's just his view, not the view of the other 11 jurors.
We don't know what the view of the other 11 jurors
right.
is, Your Honor, but all
So
it
doesn't
takes
that distinguish this from other cases where we knew with the, for example, the Lowe case, the jury foreman, the foreperson, said we're deadlocked 11-1. So that was speaking on behalf of the jury. Here we don't know that. We just know that this guy was getting impatient.
Well, Your Honor, more than impatient, saying I don't see how these deliberations can end unless I sacrifice my beliefs.
And within a reasonable time.
Your Honor, again, I think there's no indication that he understands, and in fact, I think it suggests otherwise, that there's a possibility of non-unanimity. And that's the problem here. The jury was never instructed about that.
And defense counsel didn't want any further inquiry.
Defense counsel did not want inquiry towards removal of the juror. That's correct. Suggesting that, again, people inferred that this was a helpful juror to the defense, not otherwise.
We're past your 10 minutes.
I see that. I'll save my reserving time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of the people, court number 38141. On the DiBella issue, I'd like to begin where the defense did not, and that's with the record that's before the court. Because I think, as this court's questions have revealed, the threshold issue is whether or not the jury was in fact given unfettered access to the DVD. And here, there are two mutually reinforcing aspects to the record that support our position that this court should not breach the claim. First, as this court has already pointed out, the record indicates that the jury did not receive the DVD. The trial court told the people to make a copy of the DVD with the associated equipment, the VCR, or the DVD player, and the TV, and leave it out in the hallway until, quote, the jury calls for it. There's no indication in the record that the jury ever called for the DVD. So based on that record, the only inference that can be divined from this case is the jury was never given unfettered access. Now, the defendant's repeated response is that this case fits under DiBella. It doesn't. In DiBella, in the third paragraph, the Supreme Court flatly recognized that the jury did in fact receive unfettered access to the interview tape that was contested in that case. Based on that, the people argued in DiBella that although the jury had unfettered access, given that it was unfettered, the record was of course silent as to whether the jury watched it, how many times, and whether it influenced their decision. Our Supreme Court said that due to the fact that those absences in the record were due to the trial court giving unfettered access to the jury the DVD, that did not cut against the defense.
But if the lack of the record, and I think we've established pretty well that we don't know what happened, no one really knows what happened in this regard, if it's the trial court's ruling that gives rise to that uncertainty as to what happened, who bears that risk, you or the defendant?
It's normally the party moving for error, and DiBella does create a limited carve-out, again, for unfettered use, but not for unfettered access. It seems axiomatic that an unfettered access claim would, of course, require an affirmative showing that the jury was given unfettered access, and nothing about DiBella changes that. So I think we fall under general case law, which is, with all errors, the party that's raising it for reversal bears the burden of establishing that the record that it actually happened. So on top of the fact that we have a record which is very clear that the jury did not receive it, there's an additional obstacle in the defense's way, as we point out in the brief, and that's the presumption of regularity. As our Supreme Court recently made clear in LePage, under that doctrine, it's presumed that, absent evidence to the contrary, that we presume that the trial court followed the applicable procedures. And as this court explained...
Well, but Mr. Lee, in this case, though, we do have a record from the trial court indicating its particular view of the law, which was that it could provide, indeed had to provide, unfettered access of the video to the jury. So how could, if there is such a presumption of regularity, hasn't it been overcome by that record?
No, and I think that's why we raised a separate argument, because it's a different presumption that we're relying on. Not that the jury did not make an error, not that the court did not make an error in giving the jury unfettered access, but that in order, with the record we have, the defense would also have to show that the court made an error in not recording the jury's question asking for the DVD. Because as we pointed out, as this court explained in Jones, there's statutes and rules requiring a court to put everything on the record. So the defense not only has to show that it happened, that the jury was given unfettered access, but in this case, because the record's silent, they have to show that the court also made a separate error in not recording the jury asking for the DVD.
If the record showed affirmatively that the jury did ask for the DVD and looked at it in the jury room or outside the jury room, would you confess error? Would you confess that the judgment would have to be reversed?
I would not, for two reasons. First, as we pointed out in the brief, the record does not establish that the court believed it had to give the jury access, and that is truly what a development error is. And there are three reasons why I think the record shows that the trial court properly understood its discretion. The first is, unlike the other exhibits, it asked for argument. The trial court would not have asked for argument if it thought it had to give the jury unfettered access. That's completely contrary to that conclusion. Number two, the actual court's ruling. The court did not say, I have to give them the jury access. The court said, I will permit the jury to have access. Permit, of course, again, being a discretionary word. And most importantly, I would point to the fact that the court did not give the jury unfettered access. It left it in the hallway until they called for it. So I think the best evidence we have for why the jury did not think it had to give the jury unfettered access is we know they didn't. The court did not give the jury unfettered access. So I'd argue under those three provisions that there is no Davila error in this case, on top of the fact that I think the record does not disclose that the jury ever received the DVD, therefore rendering this first issue moot.
Mr. Lee, in your brief, you argue that if the jury did in fact receive the DVD and viewed it, that this case is like Frasco, because they only got it after it had been left in the hallway. It wasn't given to them at the outset. They had to ask for it, presumably maybe they did, and then it went back to them as in Frasco. But in Frasco, there had been a limiting instruction given by the court when the video was admitted into evidence. I've looked at the record. I didn't see anything like that here. I didn't see a limiting instruction either at the time the court made a ruling on the video or when it allowed it into evidence. And the court in Frasco expressly relied upon the fact of that limiting instruction to find that there had been no abuse of discretion. So this case really isn't like Frasco, is it?
Well, one of the reasons why it's not like Frasco, it would have made no sense for the trial court to have given the limiting instruction before the jury actually had access to the DVD.
But that's what happened in Frasco. In Frasco, the court gave a limiting instruction when it admitted the video and it was played for the first time in the courtroom. And the court said because of that, the Supreme Court said because of that, and because the court waited for a request from the jury to view the video, there was no abuse of discretion.
The authority I'd point to is in the paragraph of Davila where it's discussing the things that a trial court could do that would exercise proper control. It references Frasco and says, for example, a trial court could, like Frasco, wait for the jury to ask for the exhibit before giving it. And then it lists various independent instructions that a trial court could also give. I would say under that language, you don't have to do both.
But the record here doesn't indicate that the judge was expecting, once they made a call for the equipment, to hold a hearing on whether that was appropriate or not. He just said you'll have to call for it and get the bailiff to deliver.
Yes, but I guess the argument is there's language in Davila that I would say supports that a court exercises enough control if it waits until the jury calls for it before giving the exhibit. And although the Supreme Court in DiBella didn't explain why, I think the logic is that by doing so, you're not placing undue emphasis on the exhibit for the jury. And the risk for undue prejudice is lessened given that the jury has on their own already asked to see the exhibit.
I don't understand your argument that the court did exercise control. Wasn't the state of the law at the time such that the court had to give unfettered access to the jury?
It was in the Court of Appeals, but that's kind of how we have all this crazy case law. And the Supreme Court, as it's explained in DiBella, it was that Supreme Court case law had always said that you shouldn't.
But how can you assume that, the trial judge was bound by the Court of Appeals decisions. So is it reasonable to assume that the judge would have made a ruling that was inconsistent with binding Colorado Court of Appeals cases?
I don't think we can make that presumption because the trial judge is also presumed to have to follow Supreme Court authority. And the rule of the criminal and rules of criminal procedure. So I think when we have a record like this, certainly it could lean one way or the other. But I don't think we can presume. And I think the better evidence is what actually happened and what was said and what the trial court found.
But here in the discussion of the issue, the only cases that were cited by the prosecutor who cited these Court of Appeals cases, and the court seemed to adopt the reasoning that the prosecutor was offering.
The trial court never said it was. It never firmly said it was adopting those cases. And just the three things I pointed to earlier, those are, I think, just the best evidence is how the trial court did exercise discretion. Why ask for argument if there was no discretion?
Well, and it asked for argument to determine whether it had any discretion. That doesn't mean it thought it didn't have any or did have any. It wanted to know whether it did. And the record appears to show that the court didn't think it did.
And Your Honor, I would say that that's certainly a possibility, but based on the trial court's ruling, I don't think we can affirmatively say that. And again, I think the best evidence for why the best evidence that shows that the trial court did not believe it had to give the jury unfettered access is it didn't. It left it in the hallway until they called for it.
Why shouldn't we remand this to have someone who has the authority to decide the factual question as to whether the jury did get access to it? Why shouldn't we have someone, namely the trial judge, make that determination?
Because under the current rules of just how we review error, the party moving to reverse the case has a burden of establishing a sufficient record the first go around. I mean, in this case, I think we've also had lots of supplemental records. So to the extent that this fact could have been added in, it certainly could have. And so just under the general presumptions, to the extent that the record does not disclose that the error occurred, then this court should affirm without a remand, under all the general rules of the appellate procedure that we normally follow. If the court has no further issues or no further questions on the DiBella question, I'll move to the second issue. On the trial court's decision not to respond to the jurors' statements, the difficult part for the defense is that the statement is ambiguous and their argument largely turns on inferences and assumed facts. And in this case, the people were alone in wanting to question the juror. So it's certainly our position that the alleged errors in this case were invited. If we look at what happened below, the court receives the note, the people want to question the juror. The defense says the juror cannot be excused for cause. He's claiming a business hardship. So on appeal, there's arguably two contentions of error. One, that the trial court should have inquired into the juror, or two, that he should have provided additional instruction. Both of those claims are waived. In particular, the defense counsel's argument that defense counsel did not state a position as to whether or not the juror should receive further instruction. The problem is that claim turns on a finding that the juror's note expressed deadlock. And far from saying it was a deadlock below, defense counsel argued it was a business hardship, which is essentially what the trial court found, which would not require any kind of deadlock instructions. So given that record, we certainly argue that the error was invited and the defense is precluded from raising it here. On the merits, the defendants argued that this case is reversible under Lowe. But as this court's aware, Lowe requires two things. One, a deadlock, and two, a coercive statement by the trial court. Neither of those elements are present in this case. Nothing about the juror's note indicated a deadlock. As some of this court has made clear, I think one of the best ways to illustrate why not is comparing to the cases that the defendant has relied upon. In Lowe, the juror assented to the trial court's express question that you're hopelessly deadlocked. In Martin, they said we're hopelessly deadlocked. In Fain, the juror statement said one juror has stated their viewpoint and stated he will not change it, and that's on all counts of murder. In Gibbons, we're at a standstill. So when we're looking at deadlock, the question is, has the juror expressed that they are currently at a point where they can make no progress? The juror's note in this case, at best, only established that he believed that they could reach a point where they might be at a deadlock, not that they were at a deadlock. The language was equivocal. There appears to be no reasonable end in sight. Even looking at the most favorable way to the defendant, that doesn't say deadlock, that just says there could, in a reasonable period, be a deadlock. So I'd say the first element of Lowe is missing, and the defendant's argument fails at its factual premise. Second, there's nothing coercive about what the trial court did in this case. In Lowe, the statement that coerced the jury's verdict was in response to the juror's statement that if we have to continue deliberating, one of the jurors is going to have to give up their beliefs and enter a verdict just for the sake of ending the trial. And the trial court said, fundamentally, that's how I think juries reach their verdicts. That was a coercive statement. In this case, the trial court said nothing. Now, the defense argues that the silence in this case is more meaningful because the trial court had also given an additional instruction saying that it would respond to the juror's questions. So therefore, by not responding to this question, that somehow made it more than silence. The problem with that argument is there was no question in that statement. So even under that argument, the factual premise is missing. But even assuming that the silence in this case could be meant to say anything, at worst, it was keep on deliberating. And as this court explained in Grace, when the jury actually was in fact deadlocked, an instruction to the jury to continue deliberating is not coercive. And then just briefly touching on those Supreme Court cases that defense counsel cited during argument, because those came out after we filed our answer brief, and I think the reply brief as well. As counsel pointed out, the Supreme Court kind of changed the sweep of the law and made it very clear that when we give those Allen safeguards, it's only when it's clear that the jury shows a misunderstanding of the law. And in this case, what the defense is arguing that the trial court should have instructed the jury was that not to give up their conscientious beliefs. So in order to get that instruction, the note would have had to show a misunderstanding of that rule. But to the contrary, the note actually shows that the juror knew that rule. Because even under how the defense reads that juror's note, the juror said there is no end in sight and expressed that he was not going to give up his conscientious belief. So based on that, I think under the current case law, even if there was a deadlock, even if there is a coercive statement, you don't need that curative instruction the defense counsel is asking for in this case. So if there are no further questions.
Oh, there are.
On that issue. Well, let's turn to another issue. On the accessory count, the defense has argued that there is no proof that the defendant knew that Mr. Owens had committed first-degree murder. Okay, your answer brief didn't address that argument at all. So I'd like to know what the government's position on that is.
Yeah, and I thought I had, Your Honor, so I apologize.
I don't think so.
They were both present at the shooting. Certainly the jury could find that based on the evidence presented that Ray, and also based on the implicit evidence, that Ray not only knew but directed the murder. So, and then we had substantial evidence about the accessory after the fact of him both directing the murder and then after helping him conceal his identity. So based on that evidence, I think the jury could have entered the verdict that it did.
Well, I think though the accessory charge is related to the shooting of Mr. Van, okay? And I don't think the evidence showed that the defendant was actually present at that moment, okay? So the question is, what proof is there that the defendant knew Mr. Owens had committed first-degree murder as to Mr. Van, having not been there?
Well, we have to remember that the fight began, the shootings happened after the fight had started. And I think it's after the defendant had brandished his weapon, as people argue that that's kind of what started everything that ensued. So based on that evidence, I think the jury could have inferred that the defendant was aware of everything and was a participant in everything that happened after that.
Well, it's a little bit different than complicity, because this is talking about the mens rea element that has to be proved for accessory, which the defense argues must demonstrate that the defendant was aware that as a factual matter, Mr. Owens had committed first degree murder. In other words, this is not really a complicity thing. It's not really a generally set a plan in motion, you go ahead and do this and I'll do that, kind of a deal. And it seems different to me. Am I just missing what you're saying?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I guess my answer would just be the same, that I think given the record that we have in this case, the jury could have inferred that the defendant was aware of all the crimes that happened. Because it kind of started.
That's where you're losing me, okay? That's where you're losing me. Because I think the record shows, as I said, that he wasn't present when Mr. Dan was shot, okay? He was going back to the vehicle, okay? So just because there were these signals and alleged threats being made at the time doesn't mean that the defendant knew about everything that happened after that. I mean, one just doesn't follow the other. I mean, actually knew about it.
Yeah, I would say the evidence from the beginning, also the evidence that they talked to each other about the crime after, I think reinforces that he knew about the crimes from the outset. And I guess that's the best answer I can give the court.
Mr. Lee, doesn't Gann versus People, irrespective of harmless error issues, doesn't Gann versus People require us to hold that the instruction on attempt to commit first degree murder was erroneous?
No, Your Honor. Actually, I think I read Gann differently. In Gann, the Supreme Court held that the missing element was after deliberation, and it was not in the attempt instruction. But the court found that because the attempt instruction said complete the crime of first degree murder, and that instruction provided that the elements had to be included after deliberation, that the instructions as a whole correctly instructed the jury, and therefore there was no reversible error. And that's the same thing that this court found in Beatty and in Caldwell. And in this case, we have that instruction where the attempt instruction said that the defendant had to act after deliberation and commit a substantial step. Substantial step was then defined as the act which showed the firmness of the purpose to commit the completed crime. So that instruction, along with the first degree murder instruction, clearly instructed the jury.
You can read these cases two ways, it seems to me, because all of the cases, Gann, Petschow, Beatty, Johnson, Caldwell, dealing with this issue, address the issue under plain error standard. And I think it's possible to read those cases as saying that while it is error to exclude or omit this mens rea element from the attempt instruction, it is not plain error. I think, on the other hand, it's also possible to read these cases as saying that if you read the instructions as a whole and the jury is adequately informed of the concept, then it's not error at all. How do you suppose that we read those cases?
Under the reasoning that's employed in those cases, I'd argue that they come out the same way regardless of whether they're reviewed under plain error or harmless error. And the reason is all of those cases say that there was no reversible error because the instructions as a whole clearly instructed the jury.
Yeah, and what I'm struggling with is it seems to me that if the instructions as a whole adequately inform the jury, then there's not really an error at all. There's not really a legal error. I mean, there might be a better practice of including the mens rea element in the attempted murder instruction, but there's not necessarily a legal error in failing to do so long as all of the instructions adequately inform the jury of the concept.
Yeah, and maybe to provide clarification to that, I guess, the fact that those cases say error, those cases kind of precede Riley, where it kind of explains what is and what is not instructional error. So in these cases, the case that we're dealing with specifically to this is the trial court found error because there is somewhat of an error because it's better practice to include in one instruction, but it's not reversible error because instructions as a whole adequately instructed the jury. And I think the last one of those cases might be 2002 or 2003. And then in Riley in 2010, the Supreme Court makes clear that when we're dealing with instructional error, there is no, quote, error if instructions as a whole clearly instruct the jury.
Mr. Lee, here's my problem. element 3 in instruction 16 is after deliberation and with intent, and then you go to element 4, which says engaged in conduct constituting a substantial step towards the commission of murder in the first degree, as defined in instruction number 15. And I guess my question is, after deliberation and with intent to do what? To kill or to merely engage in conduct constituting a substantial step?
To engage in conduct constituting a substantial step is a substantial step of which requires the intent to complete the crime of first degree murder, which is how the instructions read if you read them as a whole.
So what you're saying, it's impossible for Mr. Ray to have deliberatively and with intent engaging in conduct that in fact constitute a substantial step without having the deliberative and intent to commit murder?
I'm not sure I'm following your question.
Well, I'm just trying to think if there are any facts where a defendant can deliberately and with intent engage in conduct which constitutes a substantial step, but doesn't have either the deliberative intent or the intent to commit murder. Or is it impossible for that to happen?
Generally, under instruction, yes, when substantial step is defined as having the purpose, which is phrase 6 says, means intent to commit the completed crime. So it's almost like it says you have to have the intent to kill in two different parts as opposed to not saying it at all. In addition, both the Supreme Court and I think this court have already found that the instructions as given here do adequately instruct on the concept. But as a practical matter, I just think it's a curious view of the jury to say that they would not understand that to convict someone of attempt to commit murder, they would not have to intend to have committed murder. And I think given the instructions we have in this case, there's just no possibility that the jury would have thought that. In addition to the fact that I think this court's cases and Supreme Court have been very clear that this just is an error as a whole.
It's not an error, or it's not reversible error?
I would say it's not an error as we currently understand what error means in the context of jury instructions. Because again, the logic that's used in those cases is that the instructions as a whole clearly instructed the jury. So I think what those cases would probably be better saying now would be that, although not best practice, but it's not error, and certainly not reversible error.
Can I turn to the Batson issue for a minute?
Sure.
The Batson issue was resolved in kind of a unique way because, as I recall, at the end of the day, a peremptory challenge was made by the prosecutor. The defendant challenged that on a Batson basis. The court said, it's too late. Let's talk about it tomorrow. So the next day, a different person than the person who had conducted the voir dire or who at least announced the strike, after having the entire evening to think about what race-neutral reasons there might be for striking that juror, then argues. Under those circumstances, do we still defer to the trial court's judgment of the demeanor and the fact-finding process? The demeanor of the counsel was a different, because the demeanor is a different person than the person who conducted the voir dire or who made the strike.
Yeah, sure, I think we would, just because the principle of deferring to the trial court for fact-finding is whether or not they're in a better position than we are on a cold record in making that determination. So even though it was a different prosecutor, the trial court was still better suited for making that credibility determination than we are on a cold record. In addition, I would just argue that given the trial court's ruling on the Batson, it wasn't so much credibility, but the actual reasons given in that case for why it was a race-neutral reason, which I think is supported by the law, that the juror had expressed that he had an understanding of a completely different kind of law, and that the prosecutor was concerned that that might create problems with dealing with a very complicated criminal case.
Do you agree that the intent required for first-degree murder is to kill, under the way it was charged here, to kill a specific person? In other words, that Mr. Ray had to have the intent to kill the person who was killed or was attempted to be killed?
Yes, but I'd say in this case, certainly the evidence did show that. So that would be the higher standard, and I'd say the evidence definitely met it, because in this case, the jury found that the defendant intentionally shot both of the victims.
But you rely upon Mr. Ray's statement that I'll kill all of you, or I'll kill all of them. But that wasn't that at a time when the people who were later shot really weren't even in play? So, in other words, what I'm trying to figure out is how that statement, I'll kill all of you, would establish that Mr. Ray had the intent to kill the specific people that he shot.
It was one ongoing episode. That's what starts everything that follows. So certainly I think the jury could find that being relevant to the defendant's intent. In addition, as we pointed out in the brief, we also rely on the number of shots that were fired, that the defendant fired of each of the victims. And again, when you shoot at someone, that in many cases can be enough to show enough intent for murder, especially when there's multiple shots, as there was in this case.
Counsel, as I understand the facts, Mr. Bell was shot when he came to the vehicle where Mr. Ray was and where Mr. Owens was. And of course, the defendant testified as to what he believed was going on at that point. He thought that Mr. Bell had shot Mr. Owens because there was blood, there was a fight, and so he was using the gun in not so much, I suppose, self-defense, but in defense of Mr. Owens. Okay, so could you give me kind of a succinct explanation as to what the government's position is as to the proof that there was no defense of others as to Mr. Bell? Because that was, it was the prosecution's burden to disprove that beyond a reasonable doubt.
Two reasons. One is the action that happens before he shoots him. So in order to have self-defense, it needs to be reasonable. And when you use, and the force needs to be reasonable. So the facts in this case, even under defense testimony, showed that he tried to pull off Bell before he shot him. So the defense testimony was that he felt he needed to shoot Bell in order to protect Owens, and that the gunshot was the reasonable force necessary. If the defendant thinks he can just pull him off with his hand, then I think that goes to show, or the jury could certainly find, that him using the gun is not reasonable.
But didn't he say he was unsuccessful in doing that? He could not pull him off.
He said he could not pull him off, but he did not say that he needed to use a gun in order to pull him off. And second, just as a legal matter, certainly the jury could choose to reject the defendant's theory of self-defense. And the jury did in this case. So I would say based on those two things, then that's that
evidence
supports.
I guess the question is, and we're going to run a little bit over, I guess the question is, if the jury disbelieves the defendant's testimony on that, is that enough to satisfy the prosecution's burden of establishing beyond a reasonable doubt that the affirmative defense does not apply?
Yes, because the jury certainly could have found the defendant used unreasonable force. Even assuming everything the defendant says is true, the jury could have found the defendant used unreasonable force by using a gun and firing it as many times as he did. Of course, no further questions? I'd ask you to affirm all defense convictions. Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, before you start, could I confer with my colleagues for just a moment?
Of course, sure.
Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to give you 5 minutes. We're going to up it a couple of minutes, so the bailiff should reflect that we have at least 5 minutes for rebuttal. That's pretty close.
I'll concede the 3 seconds.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case is too important for this court to decide the DiBella issue based on a misapprehension of the factual record. So I now have the transcript in front of me, and I want to focus the court's attention. Volume 25, page 118, lines 10 and 11. The trial court rules, quote, "I will allow them," meaning the jury, "to have access to the DVD," end quote. The next paragraph, starting at line 12 on that page, then talks about how the court usually watches DVDs on his laptop, and he says, "I don't want to give the jury unfettered access implication to my laptop." And that's when he starts talking about the prosecutor is being ordered to bring the equipment. and a DVD. There is no reference to the hallway in that paragraph. And in fact, to the contrary, and I think supporting Mr. Ray's position here, the court goes on to say they should train my staff. I want to make sure the bailiff can go in and that the bailiff can show them how to operate it. So this is all understanding that he's given them unfettered access to the DVD. And that's why he doesn't want to give them his laptop, because he doesn't want the jurors on his laptop. The word hallway doesn't appear until page 119. And the context in which it appears, I think, supports my argument earlier, Your Honor, that what is being referred to there is the machinery and the equipment and not the DVD itself. Because what happens then after the discussion about the prosecutor needs to be able to train the bailiff, at the bottom of page 118 and top of page 119, volume 25, defense counsel reiterates his objection to this happening at all and then says, I probably don't need to say this, but I know if the people do provide the machinery, that they not be the ones that bring it back to the jury. The court says, absolutely not. And then the court says, they usually will enter the back hallway and just leave it there, and I leave it there until the jury calls for it, end quote. That's page 119 up through line 14. So, Your Honor, I think the it there, the reference for the it is the machinery. That's where I was getting my distinction from with the DVD and the machinery. I think if you really look at that carefully, it's clear that the court has ordered they can have unfettered access because the court's applying the wrong case law. We now know, after Frasco and DiBella, that failure to exercise discretion was an abuse of discretion and it requires reversal here.
But what you just read to us, does that tell us where the equipment was? Because as Judge Jones pointed out, just having the DVD itself doesn't do anybody any good. You need the equipment to view it. So where was the equipment? Do we know?
Your Honor, the record doesn't say. It easily could have been in the jury room. The court doesn't order them to leave it in the hallway. The court simply says they usually leave it in the hallway until the jury asks for it. Again, not anticipating that there are going to be any other court proceedings surrounding whether this goes to the jury or not. That's not what this is about. We're not waiting for a formal note and further proceedings to discuss it. They're just making the equipment available. So that's on the DiBella issue. On the undue risk of juror coercion issue, I want to make sure the court understands the note did not say reasonable time. The note did say reasonable end in sight. And, you know, every Colorado case that has failed to reverse for these kinds of deadlock issues has done so when there's been an instruction that was absent here. So this case is very similar to Lowe. And I don't think Mr. Lee is correct that the court in Lowe requires court coercion. It simply requires an undue risk of coercive circumstances. In Lowe, there was a sense of deadlock and we won't get anywhere unless someone compromises. And then the trial court basically shrugs and says, that's how jury verdicts are reached. And that's reversible error. Here, we don't have the affirmative, that's how jury verdicts are reached, but we have a trial court that just lets that juror note hang 4 hours, 4 long hours.
Well, what if the court had said, please continue, sent back a note saying, please continue deliberating? Where would we be?
Your Honor, I think given the affirmative indication of a risk of compromise verdict without an affirmative instruction to the jury that you should not sacrifice your honest beliefs as to the weight or effect of the evidence solely for the purpose of reaching an agreement, there would be error.
So what was the court supposed to do in your view?
Your Honor, the court should have sent such an instruction.
Which instruction?
A version of a modified Allen instruction.
Including the mistrial?
Yes.
Advisement?
Yes, which the people agreed in the Gibbons case, when you have a risk, when you have the rare circumstance presented, as you have here, that someone thinks jury deliberations are just going to go on forever, that's the rare circumstance when an affirmative advisement about the possibility of a mistrial is necessary, and absent that, you have coercion.
And that's measured by abuse of discretion?
Under the hypothetical? Your Honor, again, I think our position is structural error, but I understand the court could disagree. I see my time has run.
It is, but I have another question.
All right.
On an unrelated issue, the motion for continuance issue, I just want to make sure I understand what you perceive the record to be on that issue, because this wasn't clear to me in the briefs. At trial, did the defense call a crime scene or ballistics expert to testify?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I cannot remember that. I apologize.
We'll keep digging.
I I think the answer is no, but I am uncertain, so to be honest with the court.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. An opinion will be issued in due course.